And I'm Lisa Brin Rundle. Coming up on As It Happens.
Red flags after cost projections for hosting 7 FIFA World Cup games balloon. The Canadian Taxpayers Federation says Vancouver needs to step off the field and put those hundreds of millions to better use.
And license to shoot. Canadian Denis Villeneuve is known for films such as Arrival and Dune, and he's set to direct the next James Bond. A spokesperson for the International 007 fan club calls it a marriage made in James Bond heaven.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Thursday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. The Minnesota DNR recommends refraining from burning debris piles until later this fall. Green branches and logs won't burn well and will create smoky conditions. Piles could also reignite, creating wildfire concerns. We receive support from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. The Friends of the Brainerd Public Library continue their Brown Bag Lunch author series Monday, June 30th with Minnesota author Sally Franson. She'll discuss her new novel, Big in Sweden. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Northland Arboretum in Brainerd has a Dazzle of Dragonflies, Sunday, June 29th at 1 p.m. Learn about dragonfly species, habitat, and more with Minnesota Master Naturalists Ron and Leanne Plinsky. Registration required at northlandarb.org. Now I'm going to play a song for you. This is a tune from Anna Calvi from their 2013 album One Breath. This song is called Suddenly.
Stand on the edge of sadness that I can't face. It tastes like I'm leaving. Suddenly I'm leaving all behind. The touch and the spell.
And that's Anna Calvi with the song Suddenly.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Lisa Bryn Rundle, sitting in for Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
no such thing as a free kick, as the projected costs for Vancouver to host a handful of FIFA World Cup games next year jump again. Our guest says it's time for the city to bow out and use that money to help people across the province who are struggling to make ends meet.
Words on the street. A francophone busker is shocked by a new rule requiring musicians to sing in French only in certain areas of Quebec City. He calls the change out of tune with his diverse community.
Bill of Health, Newfoundland and Labrador's Auditor General, tells us the provincial health authority's questionable and excessive spending on agency nurse contracts should raise serious alarm.
Turning point. 10 years after the Supreme Court decision legalizing same-sex marriage in the U.S., we hear from the plaintiff who brought the case.
Bond ambition. Oscar-winning Canadian director Denis Villeneuve is taking on the next James Bond film. An expert on all things 007 says it is a dream scenario for the next phase of the franchise.
And Cus Celebre. An animal rescue goes viral for its post about a macaw with an R-rated vocabulary. As It Happens, the Thursday edition, radio that guesses that means parental guidance is advised. Hosting the biggest sporting event on the planet is coming with a shockingly high price tag. Vancouver will be the site of just 7 of the 104 games in the men's FIFA World Cup next year. But the BC government announced this week it could cost up to $624 million to put on the show. That's more than double the original estimates. The province and the city of Vancouver say security costs and upgrades to the stadium are to blame. Organizers insist that much of the outlay will be recouped by money from visitors, including a new hotel tax. But Carson Binda says the province should pull the plug on the games. He's the British Columbia director of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. We reached him in Vancouver.
Carson, these new estimates put the price tag of each soccer game close to $90 million, potentially. How does that number sit with you?
Yeah, well, quite frankly, we can't afford more cost overruns to host these 7 FIFA soccer games about 12 months from now, next summer. We know that BC and Vancouver specifically are the epicenter of the affordability crisis hitting Canada right now. When our public finances are so deep in the red, when so many British Columbians are laying awake at night wondering how they'll afford the basics, it's deeply inappropriate for the City of Vancouver and Province of British Columbia to be blowing up to $620 million to host a handful of international soccer games.
Even if Vancouver were to say to FIFA, sorry, we can't do this anymore, not at the rates we're talking about and not at, you know, the cost that it's going to come with, surely they're contractually obligated at this point and they couldn't pull out.
I don't think it's set in stone until we've got athletes walking through the streets of Vancouver and fan zones set up. Look, I don't want our politicians to fall into some kind of sunk cost fallacy over this. The big expenses that the City of Vancouver and Province of British Columbia are on the hook for revolve around security, revolve around building new facilities for visiting teams to practice in. If we don't have to spend that money, well, then that's $624 million that can go towards essentials for British Columbians. It's money that can go towards keeping our schools and hospitals open. It's money that can go towards tax cuts to keep more cash in folks' pockets to begin with. So the Premier and Mayor need to do the right thing. They need to pull the plug on this.
But those 7 games, just 7, I hear what you're saying. Many soccer fans wish there would be more in Vancouver, I'm sure, whatever the cost. This is one of, if not the biggest sporting event on the planet. It's certainly not cheap to put it on and welcome tens of thousands of fans, hundreds of players. But there are many who think a world-class city should host a global event, a spectacle like this? And it comes with costs.
Yeah, well, so even according to the provincial government's own estimates, this isn't going to make money for the people of British Columbia. Even with the increase in tourism, even with folks visiting from around the world, this is going to come at a net cost of between $85 to $145 million for BC taxpayers, according to the government's own estimates. There's also a whole bunch of peer-reviewed academic literature out there, including a 2019 paper from the Journal of Tourism Economics from the folks at the University of Hamburg, that shows hosting an entire World Cup doesn't provide good bang for the buck, doesn't increase tourism overall, let alone hosting just 7 games out of 104. Vancouver's already a world-class city. We've hosted the Winter Olympics. Hosting just 7 international soccer games isn't going to put Vancouver on the map because we're already on the map. We have rural emergency rooms across British Columbia closing overnight because there isn't money to keep them open. And we've got students being warehoused in double-decker portables in cities like Surrey because there's not money, according to the provincial government, to put them in real classrooms. I think it's grossly inappropriate to be spending $624 million on a party. And if the premier, if the minister of tourism and sport disagree with me, I'd love to hear that from them. Do they think it's worth it to have emergency rooms closing overnight, to have British Columbians cut off of life-saving medical treatments so we can host a few soccer games? Because I sure as heck don't think that's worth it.
And we should mention Toronto is hosting 6 games, and currently the estimates for those 6 games is around $380 million. So we don't know if there's suddenly going to be new estimates projected for the Toronto games as well. But why do you think Toronto appears to be getting a bargain compared to Vancouver?
Yeah, and it's not just Toronto. I mean, these games are being held across North American cities. Take a look at the Bay Area, fairly close to Vancouver, just south of us in California. Their cost estimates are several times lower than Vancouver's as well. We haven't been able to get a clear answer from the government of British Columbia, from the city of Vancouver, as to why our cost estimates are so much higher than the other cities that have stepped up to host.
Could it be that they just have the infrastructure already in place?
Well, so Vancouver has a whole whack of that infrastructure in place already. I mean, BC Place is a world-class sports venue. We have the infrastructure here at home.
And we should say, we haven't revealed so far, you are actually a soccer fan, right?
That's right. I'm a big soccer fan. You know, just about every Vancouver Whitecaps home game has me there cheering our team on. But this isn't about soccer. This is about the best use of taxpayer money. And at the end of the day, our core services that British Columbians rely on are crumbling. Our food banks across the province are seeing record-breaking demand. When that's the reality of British Columbia's public finances, it's terribly inappropriate for the city of Vancouver and province of British Columbia to be blowing $624 million to host these 7 soccer games.
When the World Cup does come, are you going to be there in the stands? Are you going to hold your nose and cheer?
Look, I think, unfortunately, the way that this World Cup is being set up, a lot of the British Columbians, myself included, who are being left with the tab, aren't going to have the opportunity to actually go and attend the games, whether it's the costs, which have yet to be officially revealed, but it's very likely they'll be prohibitively expensive just to procure tickets. If you're lucky enough to win a lottery to even get your name on the list to be able to buy the tickets. A lot of the British Columbians who are soccer fans, who are being left with the bill, won't have the opportunity to experience or participate in these games. That's another huge issue.
Carson, I'm glad we could speak. Thanks for this.
Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me.
Carson Binda is the British Columbia director of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. He was in Vancouver.
day that lies ahead. Plenty of words that I have not said. As for now, I'll let them be, just be here now with me when it's time to be there.
This is Quebec musician Bertie Veilleux on violin, along with his friend and frequent collaborator Bosco Baker, busking for pedestrians. It's something they do routinely in the streets of Quebec City, and it's something they have historically done in both French and English. But for the first time this summer, the two of the Quebec City spots most coveted by street performers are being reserved solely for French language and instrumental performances. And that has even Francophone artists like Mr. Veilleux concerned. We reached him in Quebec City.
Bertie, how did you find out that this was happening, that you were only going to be allowed to perform instrumental music or French language music at these locations?
So it was by the end of May. We have usually annually, we always have the same email asking us to renew our permits to busk. And that new regulation was just there in that mail. So we weren't warned or consulted. It was just right there at the edge of the big season.
In a statement to our CBC News colleagues, Quebec City said these venues are being reserved for French language music to mark the 40th anniversary of Quebec City's designation as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. They say it's a pilot project that will be reevaluated. So there's that. And then there's the fact that you're a Francophone. You've described yourself as a separatist even. So why is this upsetting?
Because Quebec culture is not only French. They're, you know, they forgot that we also have indigenous people here, and it means that even them couldn't busk in their own language in Petit Champlain, because this only touches the Petit Champlain area. But the beauty of busking is diversity. It's about freedom. It's about being able to showcase your art in whatever form you want, and that's why we do it, because it's something that's extremely authentic and close to the public.
Parc Félix-Leclerc and Place Royale are two of the venues. Describe what they're like and why they are so important for the work that you do.
You know, in 2016, to me, it was like the peak of busking in Quebec. You had Jérôme 50, which is huge now, Hubert Lenoir, which is also huge, Bosco Baker and the Saint-Jean Street Band, and Philippe Gagné busking, attracting often crowds of up to 250 people. Mm-hmm. It was a great time to busk, a really lively scene. Then in 2017, they decided to close one of the big spots on Saint-Jean because of complaints from residents. Jérôme 50 and Philippe Gagné went and did a petition that had almost 11,800 signatures to try to reopen these spots, and they were just brushed aside, and the spots remained closed. After that, in 2020, all the spots closed for COVID, which was totally understandable. But in 2022, when all the restrictions were being lifted, the spots remained closed. And we asked the régie to reopen them. But then after that, they moved the spot that was the one that's inside the Porte Saint-Jean outside. So instead of playing in front of pedestrians, like in the shade, you're like under the blaring sun playing in front of parked cars. So it's basically impossible to have a crowd there. Mm-hmm. So the only solution for us to keep busking, because we love it so much, was to play on the Petit Champlain. And that's a great area.
It is quite beautiful. What kinds of changes have you had to make to be able to keep busking in those spots because of the new language rules?
Yeah, so we had to, because we already had like a bit of French repertoire, mm-hmm. and we play like English originals from Bosco and the old jazz standards, traditional jazz or New Orleans swing song, Western swing songs. But what we had to do, I had to translate a lot of these songs in French to make it so that we could busk there still. But that's pretty much what we had to do. But it's kind of crazy, because when you think about it, like, you can only play songs in French or instrumental, so we could just play instrumental American Top 40. It makes no sense.
From the perspective of people, and you talked about the complaints who may have come in from people who live and work nearby, they're exposed to the same songs over and over again, you know, if they live near where the busking spots are. Can you understand where they're coming from? if that's part of what is at the heart of this?
Yeah, so there's a part of it that's just noise that I don't understand, because there's like three fun streets in Quebec, and you know, like, don't ruin it for everyone. But also, yeah, some, like, it's really weird because the audition process is pretty extensive, but still there are people on the street that play the same songs over and over again. And I can quite understand that can make you crazy, you know. But Bosco had a great solution for this. There's already two types of permits, but the idea would be to have another permit, like a type 3, to make sure that it's like real shows, you know, like it's a performance. It's not like a, because I've heard, like, it happened, like I was chilling in the Petit Champlain and I heard someone play the same song in the loop for 27 minutes.
Oh boy.
So that's not what we want on the street, obviously, you know. But the fact that, you know, Quebec City is the most regulated place in the world to busk, like I said, like it's such a human thing. It's one of, you know, busking is one of the oldest jobs in the world, and it's such a great expression of our humanity. I feel like in this day and age of ChatGPT and AI, we need this.
And I should say, in that statement, the city also said, quote, the reality of Francophones in Quebec City, particularly in Place Royale and the Petit Champlain areas, deserves to be highlighted, unquote. How could they do this better, in your view? How would you like to see Francophone culture highlighted?
So there is, like, we were already including a lot of Francophone culture in our set, like, because the sad reality of it is tourists like English music. Like, that's just a reality. But if you serve them a plate that they know and something that they like and you have their attention, then during the set, you can be like, okay, here's a rigodon, here's some Quebec trad, you know, for you. Here's a Quebec song that we really like and we want to show you, you know, now that you attract the crowd. You know, I've tried to bus Quebec trad and just Quebec trad, and it does not work at all. So it's basically just please let us do our jobs, you know, like just in French. Like, I feel like it's a bit extreme, and it's going to be even harder than usual to really connect with the audience.
Birdie, I'm glad we could connect. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Birdie Veilleux is a violinist and street performer from Quebec City. That's where we reached him. It's an epic theme that conjures up tuxedos, guns, and very specific martinis. And while we still don't know who will be the next James Bond, we now know one man who'll have a big say in that decision. Amazon MGM Studios has announced that Denis Villeneuve will direct the next James Bond film. The Canadian director of movies like Dune will also serve as the film's executive producer. Judging from the online reaction, many fans are pumped. The James Bond International Fan Club website says the choice will, quote, delight Bond fans the world over. Ajay Chowdhury is with the club. He's also the author of several Bond-related books. We reached him in London, England.
Ajay, was this the plot twist you were hoping for?
In some ways, it's more than we were hoping for. Denis Villeneuve is an A-list director on top of his commercial and critical game. He makes transcendental blockbusters and has shown he's versatile in genre and the sort of whole milieu of huge cinematic filmmaking. Denis Villeneuve has always wanted to direct a Bond film, but I think under the old regime, headed by Cubby Broccoli's heirs, Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson, maybe there was too much control held in the reins. Now with the new producer, David Heyman and Amy Pascal, I think they're seeking a more artistically broad reach. And I think this is a marriage made in James Bond heaven.
There was really, and I say this as a Bond film fan, you know, there's this thirst for information about what this new era for the franchise would be like, particularly with the Amazon connection now. So I think a lot of people are relieved and excited about this prospect. And you mentioned some of the films, Arrival, Incendie as well, Prisoner, Sicario. So there's quite a wide range, and of course, Dune on top of that. But what are you hoping Denis Villeneuve might bring to this next Bond film?
Denis Villeneuve, in his previous works, as you said, they're quite different, but ultimately they have a kind of composite vision. He's great at eliciting great performances as well as huge scale vision stuff. So he gets the human and the sort of bigger picture in his films. He also has a singular vision. I think he's very good with the writing of his films. Arrival is a masterpiece. He's good with eliciting emotion, but he's also good at high octane action, which is basically what Bond films are. Bond films have a huge, almost 70-year cinematic history, but they also innovate. They bring things new to the action party. It's the reason why James Bond has outlasted all the recent competitors and will endure. Bond films aren't just action movies. They're kind of cultural zeitgeist time capsules. And Denis Villeneuve will capture that kind of sort of granular, kind of fun, entertaining aspect of what a contemporary action thriller is. Also, he'll make it hellishly entertaining. As you've seen with the Dune movies, yeah, he can have a lot of big scale fun with it.
You mentioned Dune and how popular it was. And, you know, the chief critic at the London Times, though, is calling out the, quote, glacial pace of that film. I know many people would disagree. Even those who love Dune, though, might say that the pacing, you know, was an issue for them there. But given the range of films we were talking about, are you concerned that that pacing is going to be an issue with these Bond films? I think he was trying to probably stay true to the books, for better or for worse, with the Dune series.
I think Denis Villeneuve's handling of Frank Herbert's Dune books is a great example of how one should be optimistic of what he does with the spirit and essence of those Ian Fleming books. Kevin Maher of the Times has often got it wrong before. He's got it wrong now. In any event, it's too early to decide, and you've got to travel hopefully. I'm a martini half glass full person.
Nice.
And we can trust Denny to get the balance right between producing an entertaining picture and working in the genre, an action genre, that has a bit more zip and bang to it.
In terms of who will be cast, who do you want to see play Bond next?
Okay, the new James Bond will have the Goldilocks amount of fame. Not too much, not too little, just enough. They'll be experienced in stage, TV and film on both sides of the Atlantic, working independent cinema and also studio work. They'll be known to us, but not a star. I think they'll be much more traditional, what we expect a James Bond to look and act like and sound like. Bond is a hugely valuable brand, and you don't turn a Coke can blue. So with that criteria, the Bond actor will have to be young enough to probably push Bond for decades worth of films, three or four films at least. So with that said, I think young English actors like Joe Alwyn, Callum Turner, Jack Loudon are names that are sort of solid acting things. I also think that at the moment, the Bond franchise is like building utilities, it's building sewage and foundations. Talking about casting is like picking curtains at this stage. We're way too early.
I'm going to throw one out there. I just want to go on record because everyone I know in my life has heard me say it, so I'm going to say it. Kingsley Benadier.
Yes, well, he's one of the latest names to be there, and absolutely, yeah. I mean, whatever they are, they should be able to convincingly play, say, when the picture comes out in 2027, an ex-British Royal Naval commander who's been to public school, that's special forces, that speaks to the now. Yeah. And I think all of those names could easily do that, and I think that would contemporize James Bond to some extent. And I think, you know, all bets are off. Once again, the way they used to do things has changed. I mean, the hiring of Denis Villeneuve shows that. And I think later on, we'll see that actor has got to, you know, he's got to follow on from Daniel Craig, and those are big steps to fill. So that actor's going to want it. They've got to be hungry and ambitious and also have the acting chops and the physicality to withstand the global spotlight.
This is exciting, Ajay. I'm sure we'll speak again. Thank you.
We shall do. Bless you. Thank you.
Ajay Chowdhury is the spokesperson for the James Bond International Fan Club. He was in London, England. Regular listeners of this show will know that we at As It Happens appreciate many an animal skill, but perhaps none more than the incredible language ability of parrots. We've brought you stories about parrots who say and not to mention parrots who toss around the old. It's a thing that happens, just par for the cuss, presumably because they're humans, think it's funny, or because the colorful birds just gravitate towards colorful language. Either way, it's funny, until it's not. Like when you're in animal rescue trying to find a home for a bird who does nothing but swear. According to the Massachusetts Rescue Forever Paws, their recent charge, Hendrix, will say thank you if you call him a pretty bird. But one staffer told a local TV crew, quote, "That's as far as the niceties go. The rest is slurs and cusses, things I can't repeat on camera," unquote. Which makes Hendrix several degrees saltier than your average swearing parrot. But the pretty bird with the pretty ugly vocabulary still needed a home, with people for whom his profanity would be no macaws for concern. People who would care for him, for better, or for curse. In an online listing that soon went viral, Forever Paws warned of the R-rated vocabulary and found themselves flooded with applications. And we can now report that Hendrix has found a home, presumably among sailors. Then again, I guess I shouldn't bleep to conclusions. Here's Rough Trade with Birds of a Feather. Rough Trade with Birds of a Feather.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, Newfoundland and Labrador's Auditor General says her own blood pressure shot up as she investigated how the health authority spent hundreds of millions of dollars on private nursing contracts.
And we'll hear from a member of the Armed Forces Fleet Diving Unit who recently traveled to Belle Island to blow up a wartime artillery shell hauled up by some fishermen. Stay tuned. I'm Lisa Bryn Rundel.
And I'm Neil Cooksall.
It is 6:35, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer host, Sarah Sarah. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. Programming is supported in part by the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. A lot has changed in the past year. The speed limit has not. Speeders can expect to be stopped. Please slow down. Extra speed patrols now on Minnesota roads. KAXE's future is on the line. The U.S. House recently voted to rescind federal funding for public media. The Senate is next. Public media like KAXE brings you fact-checked news and great music, free to everyone with no paywall. Cuts will hit rural and tribal stations the hardest. Now's the time. Tell Congress, protect the federal funding that keeps KAXE and stations like us on the air. ProtectMyPublicMedia.org will connect you to your elected officials.
Last year, public nurses in Newfoundland and Labrador rallied for an audit of the province's spending on private nursing agencies. Now the results are in, and they confirm some of their fears. The province's Auditor General has released a scathing assessment of how the health authority handled those contracts. Denise Hanrahan's office found Newfoundland and Labrador Health Services mismanaged its agreements with nursing agencies, signed off on expenses that should have been flagged, and ultimately bled millions of dollars in overspending. We reached Denise Hanrahan today in St. John's.
Auditor General Hanrahan, what words would you use to describe how the health authority was dealing with these contracts?
Poorly. Poor management, poor administration, and probably overall, I would say, poorly.
Your audit found Newfoundland and Labrador spent $132 million on agency nurses in 2024 alone. Just briefly, Auditor General, what's the difference between an agency nurse and a nurse that is working in a hospital in the province right now?
So our province employs a team of nursing professionals that would be considered staff positions. And agency nurses are really contractual employees that are hired generally through a company and are paid for expenses and hourly rates type of thing is the way that they're billed. Think of it as a contractor.
Newfoundland and Labrador Health Services has said that it was because of the COVID-19 pandemic that there was this use of agency nurses. Certainly, we know that there was a lot of need at that time. But from what you've seen, how does that logic sit with you?
In our report, we do show that the spending prior to the end of the pandemic was significantly less than the spending after the end of the pandemic, and I'm talking May of 2023. I totally appreciate and understand that the pandemic was a game changer from a staffing position. My issues in this audit centered around how you could determine what needs you have, how you selected the vendor, how you negotiated with the vendor, and then ultimately when you've made the decision that you need to contractually hire staff, what you did with respect to managing their invoices and then getting yourself other alternatives that are certainly less costly from a public sector point of view.
And you've estimated that each agency nurse was costing the province about $400,000 a year. How is that different than what a staff nurse might make?
So we know new graduates that enter into the system as a new graduate of a nursing program make about $75,000 a year. Mm-hmm. The mid-scale is about $118,000 a year, and that's including their benefits. So you're looking at 3 to 4 times the cost of a nurse mid-scale.
And so I guess there's a bit of an expectation, because they're working with an agency, that there will be an increase compared to what a staff nurse would make. But you've detailed a litany of expenses unnecessary in many cases in your report. Can you tell our listeners a bit of what you found there?
So in addition to paying hourly rates, which we found for one particular agency was up to as much as over $300 an hour, they also paid for things like per diems and vehicles and various other expenses that they either agreed to in the contract, which had very vague language, or they paid even when the contract didn't stipulate it. And there were electric vehicle costs that were paid even after management said, no, thank you, we don't want to avail of the service.
So billing fraud as well then?
Well, this is where for us we started to get towards a conclusion regarding potential frauding of the province when you look at billing for electric vehicles, where we could show from the documentation we had that the nurse wasn't even in the province at the time, or the nurse was only in the province for one day out of the week. You know, this company that provided these electric vehicles was a related organization to that company, and the fact that they were rejected in their proposal, but ultimately the invoices were paid, indicates to us some significant breakdown within the organization.
There's been a lot of anger simmering, to put it mildly, on this issue for some time. Nurses were upset after the Globe and Mail's initial coverage of this issue. Last year, the province was found to have spent more than $35 million on agency nurses just from April to August of 2023. Have things changed? Has the spending tightened up at all since then?
So the Newfoundland Labrador Health Services has developed a reduction plan for reducing their dependence on agency nurses, and they've been providing a lot of public updates with respect to it. And they have achieved, it appears, based on the information that we know, up till March of this year, to have dropped the number of travel nurses that they are paying for significantly. However, it has not translated into savings, and the spending from January to March of 2025 was over $35 million.
Krista Lynn Howell is Newfoundland and Labrador's health minister. In response to your report, the minister acknowledged the problem, agreed that some of what is outlined in your report is, quote, wildly outrageous, unquote. She says she has directed health services to review your recommendations. Here's a bit more of what she told reporters yesterday.
If there is any indication of fraudulent activity, that is escalated to the authorities where appropriate. And if any disciplinary action is required on their part, be that additional training or education or even up to dismissal if that is deemed appropriate.
Do you have faith, Auditor General, that the government is going to crack down on this?
We certainly did see from the Minister of Health and Community Services a very strong reaction to our report, and the recommendations and direction that she has given the health authority certainly covered our report and would give us great hope with respect to their ability to fix this. And certainly when you think about things related to fraud, or for us one of the big issues was conflict of interest, we need that response because we need to fill the holes and make the system stronger, and we need to do that as quickly as we can.
Auditor General, I appreciate your time. Thank you for this.
No problem. Thank you.
Denise Hanrahan is Newfoundland and Labrador's Auditor General. She was in St. John's. A statement from Newfoundland and Labrador Health Services says the authority is committed to working with the Office of the Auditor General and the Department of Health and Community Services, and it notes it's working on reducing the use of nursing agencies. We'll bring you an interview with the Health Authority's CEO tomorrow. Today marks the 10th anniversary of legal same-sex marriage in the United States. The change came thanks to a Supreme Court decision brought about by plaintiff Jim Obergefell. He brought the case when his partner fell ill. He died before the court ruled. As it happens, guest host Dave Seglins spoke to Jim Obergefell days before that decision came down and asked what it would have meant to his late partner.
I think he, like I, would find it just hard to believe that our story and our names will be in history books, and more importantly, might be the story that helps bring marriage equality to all 50 states. I think he would simply be stunned.
Do you think you're going to win?
I'm hopeful, but I am trying, honestly, not to think about it too much because I know there's no guarantee. All I can do is trust in our Supreme Court living up to the ideals that are enshrined in our Constitution, those ideals of equal justice under the law and equal civil rights.
We spoke to Jim Obergefell again in 2022 after the Dobbs decision that overturned Roe v. Wade. It included a concurring opinion from Justice Clarence Thomas, suggesting that the court should revisit other decisions, including the marriage equality case.
I am quite concerned. Marriage and LGBTQ rights in general are at risk. We're seeing the rights of pregnant people and women being taken away, and the right to birth control is at risk. Seeing a Supreme Court justice put in writing in this decision, in a concurring opinion, errors in judgment were made on Griswold, which guaranteed women the right to use birth control, Lawrence versus Texas, which meant that intimacy between same-sex couples could not be criminalized, and Obergefell, which guaranteed the right to marry, should be reconsidered and reevaluated. That's a terrifying thing to read from a Supreme Court justice. And the thing that makes me feel a little less terrified by that is the fact that the other justices in the majority opinion could have signed their names to Justice Thomas's concurring opinion. They chose not to. I want to find comfort in that, but I also have to look at reality. The justices in this majority opinion, most of them during their confirmation hearings in front of the United States Senate, said that they considered or inferred that they considered a woman's right to an abortion to be settled law, to be precedent. Well, by virtue of this decision, they have proven that they were not being fully honest in their statements under oath to the Senate. So I have to take that written statement that this decision does not apply and cannot apply to marriage. I have to take that with a grain of salt, because if we can't trust what they say under oath, then I'm not sure we should fully trust what they put in writing.
From our archives, that was Jim Obergefell, lead plaintiff in the U.S. Supreme Court case that guaranteed marriage equality in 2015. Recently, people on Bell Island, Newfoundland and Labrador got some explosive news. As we told you earlier this month, two fishermen were checking lobster nets when they pulled out what appears to be a Second World War era artillery shell. The find created a buzz around town, possibly because it was cool and also possibly live and dangerous. So over the weekend, the armed forces were called in to dispose of the item very carefully. Sailor First Class Aaron Clark was part of the team called in from Halifax.
We took a plane from Halifax to St. John's, and then a local unit there, HMCS Cabot, picked us up on a boat, and we took the boat over to Belle Island.
Okay, Aaron, take us to this part when you get to blow it up. How did you go about it? What do you do?
Well, it depends on the size. In this case, the projectile was big, but not too big. So we placed some of our own explosives that we brought with us to the island on the projectile itself. And then just to be safe, we covered it in quite a few sandbags. And then we drove back a safe distance with the RCMP that were on scene with us. And we used a wireless transmitter to initiate our explosives.
So once you had it going, I mean, describe for us how much power was in it. Was it impressive or what?
It was a good boom for sure. Yeah, you could feel it a little bit, and you could probably hear it for quite a distance.
Yeah, it certainly was. So once it was, once you made the boom go, I mean, you must have gotten some attention. What did people in the area do? Did they come up asking questions and stuff?
We had lots of people coming down to the area for sure, just to check out, I'm sure, what was going on. But we still had a bit of work to do. So unfortunately, we had to get back to work and ensure that the site was safe for the public to be going back down there and make sure that we did a good job of disposing of that projectile.
I mean, it sounds like you have a lot of experience with this. How often are you coming across archival ordnance, or, you know, World War II era ordnance like this?
Yeah, more often than you might think. Our unit is fairly busy. We receive these calls quite often. In fact, I myself have just returned from a deployment in Romania. And as we speak, we have another team in Romania actively working with partner nations in order to improve the freedom of movement for all vessels in the Black Sea. So, quite busy. And we do have teams here at home and around the world doing this type of explosive ordnance disposal or mine countermeasures diving, all sorts.
Sailor First Class Aaron Clark is with the Armed Forces Fleet Diving Unit. He was speaking to the CBC's Chrissy Holmes, host of On the Go. From Send in the Clowns to Everything's Coming Up Roses, Stephen Sondheim wrote songs that define the modern era of musical theater. And now the Library of Congress in Washington will provide a permanent home to a vast collection of manuscripts from the late composer's own archives. It includes everything from a program for a musical he staged in high school to lyrical sketches for songs from shows like Sweeney Todd and Into the Woods. That's all thanks to Mark Horowitz, a senior music specialist with the library, whose mission to give the collection a permanent home began decades ago, when he personally invited Mr. Sondheim to visit the library. We reached Mr. Horowitz at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C.
Mark, tell us about that visit to the library that Stephen Sondheim made. What were you hoping he would take away from seeing what you have there?
I was hoping he'd be emotionally moved and realize that there were so many connections with his own work and his own life, and would be moved to leave his own manuscripts to us, which is what ultimately happened. You know, he had been on the Desert Island Discs radio show in London a couple of times before, and I'd seen what some of his favorite works were by other composers, and it turned out we had the original manuscripts for things like Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra and Rachmaninoff pieces and Stravinsky pieces and Brahms. But in addition to that, we had so many collections that related to him specifically, including Bernstein's collection that had manuscripts for West Side Story, the Hammerstein collection, and Hammerstein had been his mentor. So it was, I think, somewhat overwhelming for him.
How did he react when he saw all of that?
You saw sort of the wheels turn over time, and it was, oh my God, that's another thing. And then I think the last thing I pulled out was the Gershwin manuscript for Porgy and Bess. Oh. And that's when he cried. And I think that was the thing that certainly was the most emotionally moving to him.
And what about for you? I mean, this is someone you...
Watching him
working.
Cry was thrilling. If you make somebody cry, you've won the game. Then, yes.
But just someone whose work you admire also, and you're proud of what your facility has and the work that you do there. So it's just layer upon layer.
He's the entire reason I got into this profession.
Really?
So this was a dream come true, really. And to be able to affect him in that way was thrilling and gratifying.
What was it about his work?
Because I realized that it was worthy of a life study of, you know, I'd been a fan of musicals before, but his work really made me feel like this was something important. It wasn't just entertainment. It was life-changing and life-affecting in a way that I don't think I'd experienced in other musicals as much as I'd enjoyed them.
If someone had never heard of Stephen Sondheim, how would you describe his impact?
I think he opened up the field in a way that is extraordinary. You know, he made people aware that you can write a musical about anything if you do it with craft and care and intelligence and passion. You know, when you start going through the list of the musicals he wrote, you know, who would imagine you would write a musical about a serial killer whose victims get baked into pies, or the westernization of Japan, or almost any one of his, you know, or a painting coming to life with the artist who painted it. But he did them all brilliantly and in life-changing ways for people. He did what all great artists do, which is find the humanity and make you, you know, after you see or hear some of his songs, you realize, oh my God, I thought that was something, I was the only person who felt that way or thought that way or had that feeling or understanding, and he made it universal.
The Murderous Barber and Meat Pies,
sure,
Sweeney Todd,
yes.
Of course. We want to play for our listeners from the original 1979 Broadway cast recording, A Little Priest.
A good choice.
What is that?
It's priest. Have a little priest.
Is it really good?
Sir, it's too good, at least. Then again, they don't commit sins of the flesh. So it's pretty fresh.
Awful lot of fat.
Only where it's at.
Haven't you got poet or something like that?
Now you see, the trouble with poet is how do you know it's deceased? Try the priest.
Oh, heavenly.
There are pages of ideas about that song and many others, but specifically that song in the collection you have there now. What did they reveal to you?
My memory is there are 40 pages of just lyric sketches for that song. And in the margins, he often does lists of things, you know, whether it's lists of rhymes or synonyms or words that relate or whatever it is. But for that particular song, throughout the pages, he starts listing people who might be baked into the pies, the various professions or types of people. And I went through them and I counted them up and I came up with 158.
And it's true that there was a fire at Stephen Sondheim's home and that almost destroyed all of this.
In 1995, there was a fire. It started in the office, and he kept his manuscripts in a closet just off the office. And, you know, I'd seen some of the manuscripts before the fire, and when I went back afterwards, if you lifted the manuscripts out of these cardboard boxes that they were sitting in, there were singe marks outlining where the manuscripts sat in the boxes. So you had paper in cardboard on wooden shelves, inches from a fire, and it's truly the closest thing I've ever seen to a miracle in my life that they did not go up in flames.
Before we let you go, Mark, which Stephen Sondheim song do you think everyone should hear at least once in their lives?
Move On from Sunday in the Park with George. There's a section in it that I think is absolutely life-changing. I know it's been for me and other people. We've discussed it. There's a section that goes, I chose and my life was shaken. So what? The choice may have been mistaken. The choosing was not. You have to move on. And I've known people who've quit jobs, taken jobs, gotten married, gotten divorced after listening to that. It gave them the courage to make life choices. It's extraordinary. I mean, I can't think of another song that has affected and influenced more people's lives than that.
Mark, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for this.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Mark Horowitz is a senior music specialist with the U.S. Library of Congress. He was in Washington, D.C.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard right across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lisa Brin-Rundle. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Nika Sal. Take care.
Listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota, and you can also join us at KAXE.org. Tonight is mostly